The next half hour features segments from Carl Olson, Michael DeMann, and Bob Arnold. I'm Bo Wasley, and welcome to Potlatch. On July 3rd, 1962, the inauguration ceremony of the Knud Rasmussen Folk High School took place near Sisimiut in Greenland. It is the only privately operated high school in Greenland, and its director, Carl E. Olson, describes the school.
We started our winter term in November, 1st November, to the middle of May. Our students come from Greenland, all Greenland. We can get 24 students per semester. They are young people, mostly. But to come to this school, they should be 17 and a half years of age, but not limit up after. So we had the students of 17 and a half, and the eldest student was 48 when he lived the school. All kind of people, Greenlanders, who can speak Inuit language, can come to our school. And all kind of religions, this is not Christian. We started to have a few students from Canada, Canadian Inuit, from 1971. And we hope that we can get two, we can begin to get some Alaskan Inuit, Inupiat, the first time might be, and Yupik later, 1977 to 1978. We had students from Denmark, but to come to our school, they should learn Greenlandic language first, because our education language in our school is Greenlandic and only Greenlandic language. So we have Danish and English language as foreign languages. The objective of this institution to spread knowledge and information to the Greenlandic youth according to the contents of the acts on the folk high schools through the school in Sisimiut, for thereby to preserve the cultural heritage and the identity, and to strengthen them and to teach the youth of the modern Greenlandic the new necessary skills to be learned. They learn to speak Greenlandic. They learn to write Greenlandic. They read Inuit literature, Canadian Inuit, Alaskan Inuit tales, folk tales, especially Greenlandic tales. We have theater, music, make some carvings, stone carvings, and iron. They teach to make seal knit. They build kayaks. And anything, all things they want to do.
Carl continues on to describe dorm life, how students are chosen, and the board structure of the directors on the school.
One representative from the land council, one from municipality of Sisimiut, one from Women's Association of Greenland, one from Association of Municipalities in Greenland, one representative from Public Information Service, and one from the former Student Association, and one representative appointed by the Board of Directors. You can see that the background of the school is from all Greenland. And before, it was mostly Christian institution which was representative in the board members. There is plan to extend the school so that there is place for 60 students. The extension will be built with a collaboration with Women's Association. The first stage should be finished this summer. So we have place for 36 students. Before I became principal in the school, the first principal chose the students as they come. Since 1971, we changed a little bit so that when they wrote to us, we answered them with some questions, what they are doing. If they would like to come to our school by interest, or another who told them about school, or another institution who asked them to come. We informed them, give them information about that they should pay for 8% of the tuition, yes. The school is boarding school, but they don't make the food themselves. We have the kitchen and personnel there. But the students help us 3 times a week in washing their clothes and house cleaning. Before 1971, the students should be at home at 11:00 p.m. But since 71, they get a key, so they can come at home whenever they will. But their duty is to meet to the lessons at 8:00 a.m.
Wise men talked about it so before. Said the serpent God would return to him. And return the peace throughout the land. And they said the time must be
Michael Murphy. Our next segment features Michael DeMann, director of the Village Management Program for Alaska Native Foundation. He describes the pilot programs at Nelson Island in southwest Alaska and the Interior Village Association here in Fairbanks, which were formed to alleviate some of the high costs of doing business.
It has been estimated in a study done by the foundation 2 years ago that for each village corporation to fulfill its not only the requirements of the Land Claims Act, but the intent of the Claims Act, would cost them $70,000 a year. And of course, it's easily realized that almost no matter how you have your money invested, if you're a small village of 26 people, say up to a couple of hundred, you're not going to have that kind of money to do the things that you're required to do. If you're a village corporation, on one side, say your left hand, you could solve all of your problems very easily by merging with the region, like NANA has. And the region takes care of your administrative problems, your land planning, your investments, your all the problems that you have with your village corporation. You don't have to worry about digging up $70,000 a year. At the same time, of course, you effectively lose control of your village corporation, because its assets are in the hands of the larger structure. On the far side, say the right-hand side, if that's the left-hand side, you can have a kind of a loose association in which you kind of share information and maybe share with the services of a land planner or something else as on a as-need basis, but not on a full-time active basis. We picked two types of associations in between that left and that right hand for demonstration projects. We picked a cluster concept, and the place that we implemented it was on the west coast of Alaska in the Bering Sea, Nunavak Island, Nelson Island, seven villages, consisting of Tuksuk Bay, Tanunuk, Merkoyuk, Nightmute, Unkamute, Nutuk, and Shafornuk. We also developed, with the help of the Doyon leadership, the Interior Village Association, which is a slave corporation for the villages in the interior, which does for those villages only the things that they do not wish to do themselves. Basic accounting systems, some help in land planning, some training for the members of the boards of directors in fiduciary responsibilities, some assistance in putting together grants, investments, other things, but only if the villages request it. The seven villages in the Bering Sea, on the coast of the Bering Sea, have been our most exciting and I think probably our most successful project. In the year and a half that we've been working with them, we have found that that type of concept of 3 to 7 villages united with a field representative or a general manager serving all of the villages allows the best use of resources and the most makes the most of the chances for opportunities. Each of the villages in that area shares expenses on a percentage basis, depending on how many shareholders they have in the corporation. For example, if you had 125 shareholders out there, you would have about 10% of the Coastal Management Corporation, and your contribution then would be 10% of that budget. If they agreed on an investment, your share would be 10%. Your return would be 10%. Village investments are, by their very nature, low profit margin return and very difficult to manage. However, they fit needs which the people who own the corporation feel are necessary, and therefore they should be of primary importance. At the same time, the people who own stock in the village corporations, who do not live in the village, could have a very legitimate gripe and actually a lawsuit if they saw that the use of their money, of which they own a piece of the corporation, was used for village projects when they don't live there. So what we've done is this. We found some investments in town which are of very low management factor and which have a rate of return in after-tax income in one investment alone of $130,000 a year, plus equity interest in the buildings and the land. We now take that money, $130,000 a year profit, deduct the cost of running the management corporation for the six villages, which is $75,000, and the rest we match with Indian loan programs and other guarantees on a 90-10 financing. We invest that back in the village. If the village investment doesn't make very much money, or actually, in some cases, doesn't make any money at all, that is simply deducted from the taxes that we have to pay on our in-town investment anyway. So what we're doing is we're using Uncle Sam's dollars to help defray the cost of certain basic needs and services that the people have determined they want in the villages.
Thank you.
That's the title song to Michael Murphy's album Swans Against the Sun. In our final segment, Bob Arnold of Alaska Native Foundation highlights some activities of the Center for Equality of Opportunity in Schooling, of which he's the director.
Our idea was and is that schools can be made more multicultural. This is particularly in reference to urban schools now that I'm speaking. Most textbooks are written from the standpoint of white destiny. I guess the best illustration of it is the high school history text used in Bethel and in Mount Edgecombe. And there's one chapter in the book about Indians, American Indians, and the chapter is titled The Indian Problem. You can see whose destiny is involved, and it's not the Indian's destiny. So what we hope to do in this 12-month project is encourage school districts to take a look at their educational program, their curriculum, and see to what extent it is multicultural or multi-ethnic and non-sexist, and develop plans to make it so. Now, we are not a regulatory agency. We're not an enforcement agency, though our contract is under the Civil Rights Act. We are technical assistants. It's up to a school district to want to do this kind of thing before we assist it in doing so. Some of the projects that we are carrying out are human relations workshops. And, during the first 6 months of this year, Jane Yamashiro of our staff has conducted 17 workshops, some dealing with cross-cultural awareness, some dealing with values clarification, others dealing with sexism, images in textbooks of man and woman, images of Indians, blacks, Chicanos, and whites. These workshops are typically for teachers. They may sometimes involve students, and they may sometimes involve school board members. Essentially, though, we serve school districts, not the public at large or Native organizations, though we are operated by a Native organization, the Native Foundation. For the rural districts, we have produced what we call a screening instrument for teacher applicants. Over the years, the complaint has been made that it's difficult to transform a person in a short-term in-service training day. By person, I mean a teacher. And educators have said the important thing is to choose the right person in the first place, someone who can show respect for another culture and afford dignity to all students, even though they are of differing backgrounds and may speak English differently from that of the teacher. So with the assistance of school superintendents, we have developed a questionnaire, which several superintendents show considerable enthusiasm for, that would go in any information packet to a teacher who wanted to teach in rural Alaska. The whole point of the questionnaire would be to reveal more of the applicant as a person to the superintendent so that he can think about whether he should transport the person for an interview or not. Some school boards in rural areas are very resistant, let's say, to authoritarian teachers. It will be helpful to them to know in advance what kind of person they're thinking about hiring. In the curriculum area, we have an effort underway to produce what we are conceiving of as a history teacher's companion for Native studies. In other words, it wouldn't be a Native studies course, but it will be a collection of readings that and access points indicated so that a teacher can turn an American history course, whatever book he or she is using now, into a course which also gives the learner the opportunity to know about Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts of Alaska. By access point, I mean, for instance, the American history text which is used may simply say that in 1867, the United States purchased Russian America from Russia. And at that point, the teacher would be guided to this companion work that would allow him or her to bring in how long Alaska had been settled and how many people were here at the time of the transfer, and how many there were at the time the Russians first landed in 1741. And it would bring in some Alaska history that would otherwise not be known, including history of Alaska natives and their 110 or 115 centuries of occupation before the Russians showed up.
Michael Murphy. I'm Mo Osley, and thank you for listening.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.